Hello and welcome back to Paleocast. I'm Dave Marshall.
And I'm Laura Sol.
And today we've got the second part of your Australian adventure.
Yep, so this time I spoke to Karen Black. She's actually in the same research group as Robin Beck that I was chatting to last time. So they work in a similar field area. They both go to Riversleigh to get their fossils. But Karen obviously sort of studies slightly different things. So Robin, we were chatting about things like methods and phylogenetics and filling in gaps in the fossil record. So sort of broad scale evolution of marsupials. But with Karen, I spoke about the fossil site itself. So actually going out there, doing the field work, finding the fossils, getting them out of the rock and sort of the fossilization process. And then also what we can tell from looking at those fossils. So so we chatted about some really interesting things to do with reconstructing past environments and understanding climate change over the past sort of 50 million years based upon these marsupial fossils.
So at the end of this one, we should really all be marsupial experts then.
Yeah, definitely. I'm not sure I feel like a marsupial expert yet, but I've definitely talked to a lot of Australian paleontologists about them.
Well, we're all a step in the right direction at least.
Yeah.
So I can't wait to hear this one, so let's just get straight on with it.
I'm here with Dr. Karen Black, who's a paleontologist at the University of New South Wales. Hi, Karen.
Hello.
So I understand the current focus of your research is on mammals. Has this always been your main group of interest?
That's right, yeah. I mainly focus on Australian marsupials, and in particular, one of my favourite groups are the wombats and koalas, and also the extinct families related to those groups.
Listeners are probably pretty familiar with wombats and koalas. What's their fossil rock record like? Are there a lot of extinct species?
There are, particularly for koalas. At the moment, there's only one living species of koala, but we have up to about 20 species in the fossil record. And also for wombats, they date back to about 25 million years ago.
In modern marsupials, we can see the differences between them and other types of mammals. So the other types of mammals are placental mammals, which we see more commonly in the Northern Hemisphere, in Europe or UK, where I'm from. And we know that things like kangaroos and koalas keep their young in their pouches, and that's quite an obvious difference. What kind of differences do you actually see in the fossil record of these animals?
Mostly what we rely on in the fossil record is differences in teeth. Quite commonly, marsupials have four molars, whereas placental mammals only have three. And there's a few other features of the skulls that are different between placental mammals and marsupials. But we understand that they're marsupials that we're finding because a lot of them have living representatives, and we compare their morphology to those of living representatives.
Your research group seems to have quite a unique fossil site at Riversleigh. Could you tell us a bit about that and what it's like to work there?
Yeah, definitely. I've been going up to Riversleigh for about 20 years now. It's a wonderful place. There's over 200 fossil sites actually at Riversleigh, at covering from 25 million years ago up until Pleistocene. So it really gives a great indication of changes in faunal lineages for the last 25 million years. And one of the fossil deposits that I focus on is called AL90 site. It's a cave deposit, and it's about 15 million years old. Most of the fossils at Riversleigh are preserved in limestone, and we use techniques like sledgehammers and light explosives to actually extract the fossils, or into bite-sized nice blocks that we can take back to the lab, and then we process those blocks of limestone in acetic acid. And that eats away at the limestone and leaves these beautiful, beautiful fossils.
Do they ever get damaged by the excavation process of using sledgehammers?
Yes, definitely.
Okay.
Usually we don't know what's in a block. You might see some material eroding out of the surface, and that gives an indication of that there are fossils in there, but you don't know what extent that is until you crack them open. And usually the line of weakness when you do crack it open is right through a skull, something important. But we have techniques to, we have wonderful preparators that can actually glue these specimens back together before they're put in the acid to be processed.
So if they're being preserved in limestone, do you end up with very good preservation, or is there a variation?
There is a variation, but at Riversleigh, we get some beautifully, exceptionally well-preserved skulls, which are relatively uncommon in most fossil deposits. So, yeah, you'll get beautiful things preserved. At one site at Riversleigh, at AL90 site, you get pouch young skulls preserved, and these are really, really delicate structures. You get tiny bat skulls, which are only about 1 centimetre long, 1 to 2 centimetres long, and millions of bat bones. So, yeah, the preservation is amazing.
And so you've got all those animal species. Do you get other things in there as well, like kind of plants or just other stuff that can tell you about the environment that they were living in?
Mostly at Riversleigh, it is just animals. The conditions that preserve plants are a little bit different, but we do have some deposits at Riversleigh that do preserve plant material. They're not as common, but sometimes we get seeds and fruits preserved, plant material, insects and things like that. So, but yeah, mostly we're just getting vertebrates.
Okay, and how do these fossils actually get into the limestone in the first place?
Well, Riversleigh is a karst system, and so in the terrain there today, there's a lot of subterranean caves and things like that. So if you get instances where an animal will be walking across the ground and will fall into these caves and get preserved in that way. Others fall into pools, and generally... they're so well preserved because they get immediately or very quickly covered in a hard crust of calcium carbonate, and that preserves the fossil. So whereas if you've got a really muddy deposit, the fossils in the deposits tend to get affected by erosion and weathering, whereas these fossils are actually coated pretty quickly and solidified pretty quickly.
You said that the environment's pretty similar to today. Do you think we're still getting things that are undergoing that same process now that will be fossilised and we could dig them up in
yes,
the future?
Yes, definitely. In the sense, the environment, the terrain is similar in the sense that it's limestone, but the environment is quite different today. It's quite arid, whereas 15 million years ago it was rainforest. But yeah, you do get these cave systems and animals falling in. We see kangaroo bones there in pitfall traps today.
Do you ever see any soft tissue preservation at all, or is it just the bones?
Mostly the bones. Sometimes you do get an impression, perhaps when a skull comes out, of what you think might look like a bit of an eyeball or something like that, but no, usually. And you get casts of endocranial casts of brains and things like that.
Yeah.
But mostly it is just the bone.
So we're in a lab at the moment, and we're surrounded by fossils, I can see. So there's bits of rock everywhere and fragments of fossils all over the place. Could you sort of describe what we're actually looking at and what part of the process these things are in?
Yeah, definitely. So a lot of this material, this is what the fossils look like when they come out of the limestone. So most of them... they've been surrounded by limestone. They've been put in acetic acid. We use a solution of about 5 to 10% acetic acid, and it eats away at the rock and leaves these beautiful fossils. We collect them in sieves at the bottom of the vats. Usually we change the vats about once a week and replenish the acid. So, yeah, what we're seeing here are the remains of all the fossils that were left in a particular block of limestone. So you can tell that it's really quite rich. We get literally hundreds of bones in a relatively small piece of limestone. So these fossils are awaiting to be prepared. They'll be glued together. Some of them have been broken in the actual processing stage. So they'll be glued back together, and they'll be given a registration number and handed out to the various researchers that are working on those different groups of animals.
So can you actually, these things are in tiny little shards for the listeners, can you actually glue these things back together to kind of get whole skeletons at all?
Yes, you can. Usually With some deposits at Riversleigh, we do get whole skeletons and we do get articulated material. So you know that a lot of the bone belongs to one individual. But a lot of the stuff at Riversleigh, it's just all mixed in together. So you might, because our preparators are so wonderful, they can identify different fragments from one bone and glue it back together. Most of the material comes out relatively completely anyway. But it is difficult sometimes to associate different bony elements to one individual. So you've just got a mix of species in there.
From quite a lot of research that I've read, with mammals, relatively often the fossils that you're finding are just a single tooth or part of a jaw. It sounds like you have a lot more material available than that. Have you actually looked at other things, and what have those told you?
Yes. At Riversleigh, mostly in the past, we've concentrated on fossil skulls and teeth, and that's given us a good idea of what animals are actually eating and the range of animals that are there. But not so much has been done on the skeletons. And at the moment, I'm currently doing a project where we are looking at the skeletal material. And it actually, because it's the actual part of the animal that is interacting with its environment, it can tell you volumes about what it was actually doing, whether it was up in the trees, whether it was digging, whether it was a fast runner, potentially that the environments were open or whether they were closed environments. So I think from what we've been looking at recently, we can see that the diversity of Australian marsupials we have today is nothing like what there was 15 to 20 million years ago. For instance, this one animal, which is close to my heart, it's called Myrmidon. You'd describe it as a long-legged wombat. It's a diprotodontid, and they were really common. There's probably close to 40 species of this family, and they're very common in Australian fossil deposits, and most of them are quite large, and we find lots of them. So it suggests that they were roaming in herds. But recently we've been able to look at the skeleton of Myrmidon and found that it's actually quite similar to the modern koala. So based on the skull, we just assume that this animal was like other diprotodontids and was, because of their size, roaming around on the ground. But looking at the actual skeleton, these guys were actually climbing trees. And these animals were probably about 70 kilos. And the largest arboreal mammal, marsupial today, is living in Australia today, is the koala, and it only gets up to about 13 kilos. So past environments, we're only just finding out how diverse they really were by looking at other features of the skeleton. At AL90, it's kind of unique at Riversleigh because we are getting that articulated material, and we're also getting like pouch animal skulls and things like that of this one animal called Myrmidon, which is this guy up here. So yeah, some of the preservation of the material is just pretty amazing.
Yeah, is that completely unique, finding sort of, well, pouch young, so baby marsupials?
Yeah, it is definitely. Not many sites in Australia have it, or around the world. So for this one cave deposit to have this growth series of skulls was pretty amazing. And some of the skulls are so young, some of the pouch young, they're so young, that the bones in their skulls haven't actually fused together yet. So what we were getting out of the blocks were associated bits of individual bones that hadn't actually fused together yet but were still in position.
Has that taught you a lot about these species, being able to find specimens of their young?
Definitely. We've been able to see that from the development of the skull, that these guys were actually developing in quite a similar way to modern marsupials. So in the really young pouch young skulls that we're getting, the areas around the mouth and the teeth are really well developed, but say the back of the skull is not so much. And that's related to the marsupial reproductive style, where marsupials are born at a really, really underdeveloped young age, and they have to crawl up their mother's abdomen into the pouch and attach to a teat. So what we see is usually you get well-developed forelimbs and for climbing up the belly, but you also the region around the mouth where the animal has to actually attach to the teat, that's super hyper-developed relative to, say, the back of the skull and other regions of the skull. So it has been really interesting. We can look at all sorts of development because we've got such a range of animals of one species.
So there's quite a lot of material just on the desk here. How much of what you've ever taken out of Riversleigh is this?
Oh, just a fraction of a percent. Yeah, this is not even material from one collecting season. So each field season we tend to collect between 2 and 4 tonnes of limestone material and bring it back for processing, and we'll literally get thousands and thousands of bones. In one block you can get 1,000 bat bones if it's a cave deposit and you've got fossilised remains of the bats that were living in the cave. You'll get thousands of bones just in one block. So this is, only a minor percentage.
Okay. How often do you end up describing new species?
Very regularly, actually. It's quite surprising because every year, we've been working at Riversleigh for so long now, it's amazing that new species are still turning up. So we'll have, 20 new species described each year that's coming out of Riversleigh.
How many of you are there working on the project at the moment?
There's a range of scientists all around the world working on their specific focus groups, so it's probably about 100.
So you've mentioned it covers actually quite a long period of time. Can you sort of see evolutionary changes that you can kind of link through so that you can understand a bit about the evolutionary paths of these animals?
That's right. That's what's brilliant about Riversleigh is that a lot of the animals that are alive today have their ancestors at Riversleigh. So we can track changes over 25 million years, how these animals are evolving and adapting to their changes in environments and things like that. So, it gives a really good deep time perspective of how animals have evolved and how they got to their current state.
And you were saying earlier that although the terrain's the same, the environment was quite different. What sorts of things would you be looking at with these fossils to understand the environments they were living in or their ecology or behaviour from the fossils themselves?
Well, the actual bones that are preserved tell you volumes about what an animal was doing, what its position was in the environment it lived and how it interacted with other species in the environment. So you can look at things like all of these, the shapes of bones, the length of bones, what processes on the bones, the distribution of the processes and size of them for muscle attachment tell you what these animals were doing, whether they were digging or climbing trees or whatever. So you can get a really good indication of what these animals were doing just from morphology, and also their teeth, because their teeth are adapted to what they're actually eating. But also you can also look at geochemical signals in, say, fossil tooth enamel. You can get an idea of what animals were actually eating and the environments they lived in.
Is that to do with, so what they ate ended up being what was used to kind of grow and build their teeth, or is it to do with things that get left on the teeth?
When the actual enamel is formed, it's the carbon in the environment, and as that enamel's being laid down, you're getting carbon from the different vegetation that it's eating, and that can tell you what kinds of plants it was eating.
So could you paint a picture for us of what the area would have been like at that time in terms of the climate, the types of animals or plants that were there, and maybe how they were interacting?
Around about 25 million years ago, Riversleigh was probably an open forest environment, so we get a lot of large animals preserved, lots of big diprotodontids, which are, I guess you'd describe them as long-legged wombats. They're completely extinct now, roaming around in herds. And then as you move through the Miocene, say from about 23 million to about 15 million years ago, we get rich rainforest deposits, so high biodiversity, lots of species of possums and koalas and all living together in one community. It would have been similar at that stage to temperate rainforests we see today, with a really high species diversity. And then from about 15 million years on, Australia started to dry out, so you're getting we get less deposits at Riversleigh, and you tend to get larger animals that are increasing. They're increasing in body size to accommodate the changes in vegetation and the reduced nutrition of the vegetation.
And can we relate the evolution of the species that you've been looking at in those fossils and the species that we see today? Can we relate that in any way to how the environment or the temperature has changed?
Yes, you see a lot of changes in different lineages. You see around about the 15 million mark at Riversleigh, we see a lot of rainforest groups die out. Whole families don't appear in the fossil record after that. And then you get families that we're familiar with, like modern-day kangaroos, and they tend to diversify in environments because they're well adapted to these drier environments. And you see, if you, say, look at kangaroo teeth through the last 25 million years, they tend to increase in size, the enamel gets thicker, and that's a response to the changing environment and how these animals are adapting to drier conditions and harsher vegetation. So one group I'm particularly interested in is koalas, and the oldest koala fossils are about 25 million years old. And there was quite a high diversity in rainforest. In saying that, generally only two or three, mostly one, species of koala lived at any one time. And the koala species that were present in rainforest, they were a lot smaller than the ones today. And their teeth indicate that they were feeding on much softer vegetation. And also that they were probably, from what we can tell from their skulls, they were a lot more active and agile than the modern koala. So you had a high diversity of species, but they were relatively rare in these rainforest deposits. And then as we get closer to today, the modern koala species fossil record extends back about 350,000 years that we know of. It appears to, at about 15 million years ago, we lose quite a few rainforest koalas. They just become extinct. They're no longer present in the fossil record. We don't see them. What we get is a greater abundance of more modern genera, like the modern koala. So it appears to have adapted to the spread of open forests and actually evolved with the spread of open forests and benefited in that way by increasing in numbers today.
So at the moment you are gaining an understanding of how the evolution and extinction of these animals has related to changes in climate over time. And obviously that's something that's quite relevant and important now. Can our understanding of those historical things help us to address things like conservation questions in the present day?
Yes, most definitely. It's really important, conservation-wise, to get a deep time perspective of what's been happening in certain lineages. Modern ecologists can look at changes over several years, but they can't really get that deep time perspective. Whether a lineage is diversifying, whether it's heading towards extinction, or whether it's actually just been stable throughout the period of climate change in the past. So looking at changes in lineages and numbers of species and what these species were doing in their environments, we can get, it really gives a baseline of information of what could potentially occur with climate change in the future and what the effects of man-made impacts on environments are doing to modern ecosystems.
So do you think that information is something that could be applied in a general way to lots of different groups and not just sort of Australian marsupials?
Oh yeah, definitely. It's a worldwide phenomenon, particularly in other areas in the world where fossil deposits, they have far more continuous representations of fossil deposits in terms of time. Australia, we have these massive gaps in the fossil record, so there's critical periods where we don't know what's actually happening or what has happened. But in other countries, you get these continuous fossil records, which is brilliant for conservation purposes. At the moment, there's a study being done by Mike Archer at UNSW and a PhD student, Hayley Bates, and they're looking at the mountain pygmy possum, Baramis parvus. And at the moment it's endangered, and its habitat, which is in montane snowfields, boulder fields, is under direct threat from future climate change. So they've been looking at the fossil record of these guys and found that at Riversleigh, they haven't changed in morphology significantly for the last 25 million years, and they were alive in rainforest. So from looking at that information and the history of that animal over the past 25 million years, they've been able to identify that the possums probably would be able to survive today in certain rainforest areas, and it has assisted with identifying areas that might be good for translocation of these animals when their current habitat is completely destroyed by climate change.
So does this research group of people working in Riversleigh work collaboratively with conservation scientists?
Yes, they do, yeah. At the moment, particularly with the Barramees project, they're working with modern ecologists, and they're establishing breeding programs as well for potentially translocating animals into other environments.
So do you think there's still a lot more to find out from these fossils?
Definitely, definitely. As I was saying, we know about what they were eating from their skull and from the morphology of their teeth, but we really don't know how they were interacting with their environment, what they were doing, how they were interacting with each other, what level in the trophic system they lived in, what their actual niche was. And until you understand these sorts of things, you can't really get a good idea of what an ecosystem was like and what a paleo community was like. So we're learning new things every day.
All right, well, thank you very much for that. That was really interesting.
Thank you. It was great talking to you.
Wow, I really enjoyed that one as well. I think I've got a new favourite group of vertebrates.
Oh, yeah?
Yep. I mean, it's not really saying much for someone who's so into arthropods, but marsupials are very interesting.
But they'll never replace the chasmataspidids.
No, never. I'm sorry.
Did I pronounce that right?
You did.
Yes.
Very well done.
I'm learning.
And I'm learning about marsupials. And who would have thought long-legged wombats?
Yeah, there's actually, if everybody goes and looks on the website, there's some artist reconstructions or impressions of what the long-legged wombats would have looked like.
I think we need to make the long-legged wombat famous. Get it out there on social media. The world needs to see this. Because I had no idea about these kind of animals. I mean, as I said, I'm an arthropod guy, so when I finally do see all of these weird and wonderful mammals that are so similar to what I'm used to seeing, but also really different, then that's really interesting for me.
Yeah, and they're a really interesting group anyway, just because they're obviously very similar to placental mammals that we get in the Northern Hemisphere, but have had a sort of slightly different evolutionary history. But you can see the same sorts of things happening in both lineages, so it's really great for understanding questions about evolution generally as well.
Well, I hope you've all enjoyed this episode as well. If you have, please share us on Facebook, and also give us a tweet on Twitter and give us a tweet at Paleocast. I had to think about that one then.
Just at Paleocast. It's not very hard to remember.
Everyone can remember that one.
Yeah. And if you have any requests, if there's anyone you know of that you'd like us to interview, or your favourite fossil and you want us to go find an expert on that, then let us know.
Yeah, sure, get in touch. I mean, we've had some people asking about requesting maybe Lagerstätten or these sites of special preservation, kind of like these Riversleigh formations in Australia. You can learn so much from them, and there's so many that we could cover. And then also different groups of animals or plants. We've had someone asking about canine evolution. So just give us a shout if there's anything you're particularly interested in. We can see what we can do for you. And, you know, maybe we can send Laura to another foreign country, another faraway land.
Please request that. That would be good.
Okay, and we'll see you next time.
Bye.
Paleocast was brought to you by Dave Marshall with Joe Keating and Laura Soule. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, with music supplied by the Ocean Collective. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material to this episode and for our archive of past programmes. Subscribe to our Twitter feed at Paleocast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.
Are they, are wombats just, do they have dwarfism?
I don't know.
That would have been a good question to ask.
Yeah.
Missed out on that one.
Oops.
Wombat experts, if you know, get in touch.
I want you to say that it was the shortest episode of Paleocast ever, because I think that's funny.
I think it's the neatest episode of Paleocast ever.
I'm pretty much covered in mud from head to toe at the moment.
And you'd still record Paleocast before going to get a bath.
Yeah, well, you're a hard taskmaster, and I must do what you say.
I rule with an iron fist.
You say, come, record an introduction, and I come and record an introduction. I haven't even had dinner yet. I'm cold, I'm muddy, I'm starving. So you're not going to have 15 minutes of outtakes?
No, because we don't have 15 minutes of outtakes. We can make 15 minutes of outtakes. Just turn it off.
Just turn it off.